So thank you very much. Thank you very much for the invitation. Thank you, the organizers, for giving me the opportunity to give a little bit of my perspective about loop quantum gravity. So in this talk, I will tell you about a little bit about the construction of the theory, some of its achievement, the main achievements, and some of the open questions that remain to be solved. So loop quantum gravity, and now, loop quantum gravity is meant to be a band independent approach to the problem of quantizing gravity. It takes seriously the lesson from general relativity, that is a diffeomorphism, that due to diffeomorphism invariance implies that no natural general splitting between the space-time geometry and the background can exist. And even if you insist in doing perturbation theory, then you have to face the problem that in a standard perturbative quantization, the causal structure that you will expect to fluctuate in the full theory of gravity is rigid and given by the background to all orders of perturbation theory. And of course, you have to face also the problem that general relativity or gravity is non-renormalizable. So you have ultraviolet divergences and you need infinitely many counterterms to cure them. And so the effective action that you can write loses its predictive power. So one has to go background independent, which means that you lose some of the main tools for quantization that we are familiar with, especially Fox-based method. There are no more harmonic oscillators to quantize. Euclidean methods, weak rotation become unavailable. One could, in principle, think of a scattering approach where asymptotic backgrounds actually do make sense, asymptotically flat spacetime, the sitter or anti-de Sitter spacetimes, and think of a scattering perspective. However, such point of view might be useful for answering some questions, but it's not viable for starting and trying for stating and trying to solve some of the key questions of quantum gravity, such as the fate of singularities inside black holes and in cosmology, and understanding the way in which ultraviolet divergences of standard matter interactions are regularized by quantum gravitational effects. So how do we approach the problem? We start with a canonical quantization, which means that we start with canonical methods applied to a certain formulation of gravity. The formulation we start with is gravity in first order variables. So one has the basic fields are given by the tetrads, a tetrad of one forms and a Lorentz connection. And one of the very appealing features of this action, this is the action of gravity in terms of these variables, is that the most general action that is compatible with diffeomorphism invariance and with internal Lorentz transformation has finitely many terms. Not only that, but the equations of motion that follow from this most general action are just Einstein's equations with a cosmological constant. So most of these terms are just topological terms. Of course, you also need first order variables. If you think of the statement I just made is true for pure gravity, of course. And the type of variables that we are introducing are absolutely necessary if you were thinking about coupling general relativity to fermions. Also in these first order variables, it's natural to introduce non-local extended objects that behave well under diffeomorphisms, and they will play a central role in the theory. One of them is the holonomy of the connection, and the other, the fluxes of this two forms that you construct out of the tetrad one forms. So let me quickly talk about the phase-based structure of the theory in these variables. So I'm going to specialize to, instead of dealing with the most general action, take this simpler case, but the statements I will make are valid in general. So this is the action we start with. I'm going to start with the first term is just the Einstein-Cartan theory, and the second term is the so-called Hall's term, whose coupling is controlled by this parameter gamma that is the parameter. So you can access the phase-based structure of the theory by looking at the variation of the action. When you vary the action, you get the bulk term, which contains this equation, the equations of motion. These are Einstein's equations here. And you get a boundary contribution, which encodes the parametrization of the phase space. This is the so-called symplectic potential. So here you see that the connection, the Lorentz connection, can be taken as the Lorentz the Lorentz connection can be taken as a configuration variable, and the conjugate momenta are given by these combinations of the tetrad fields. But immediately you face an issue, because the number of degrees of freedom that you have in the Lorentz connection does not match the number of independent fields in the momenta, in the conjugate momenta. So in fact, you see that the conjugate momenta actually satisfy constraints, because in terms of only 12 of the tetrad fields. And these constraints are called the simplicity constraints. So you have to deal with that, imposing the constraints, or by reducing the gauge symmetry. And so if you go to the time gauge, which consists of taking the time-like component of your tetrad field to be aligned with the normal of your space surfaces in terms of which you define the Hamiltonian formulation, then you reduce the Lorentz symmetry down to rotations, to SU2. And by doing so, the pullback of the zero component of the tetrad that I am emphasizing here is just trivially, is zero on the surface, on sigma, on the Cauchy surfaces. So it's just one line of very simple algebraic, of very simple algebra tells you that the symplectic potential actually becomes this. And you see that the new configuration variable is this combination of components of the Lorentz connection, and that actually behave like a connection under gauge transformation, under the residual SU2 gauge transformation. This is the Ashtekar-Barbero connection. This is the configuration variable that we will use in loop quantum gravity. And the conjugate momenta now are these two forms, but this much of the number of components has been resolved. And so you arrive at this parametrization of the phase space of general relativity, which is isomorphic to the phase space of a Jahn-Mills theory with a gauge group equal to SU2. And if I am giving you this a little bit of these details, it's because with that, it's very easy to understand one of the main implications of the approach, which is the discreteness of the spectra of certain geometric observables. And the reason is that we just showed that there is an SU2 connection, and its conjugate momentum is given by the analog of electric fields, of non-abelian electric fields of Jahn-Mills theory. These electric fields are written here. They are wedge products of these one forms. And so because these electric fields are related to the tetrad, to the triad in the time gauge, then they carry geometric information. So one can easily compute a natural observable associated to this electric field, which is its flux on a two-dimensional surface. And you need to smear it with the Lie algebra valued smearing function alpha or beta. So let's consider the smear electric field, flux of the electric field on this two-dimensional surface. Now we would like to compute the Poisson algebra of two of such fluxes. In order to do that, you have to rewrite this two-dimensional smearing in terms of a three-dimensional smearing. You can do that by using the usual identity, and Stokes' theorem, that's the word I was missing. And so by using Leibniz's rule, you can re-express this. So you use Stokes' theorem and you express this as an integral in the bulk of a ball for which this two-dimensional surface is the boundary. And then using Leibniz's rule, you obtain a term which is proportional to the Gauss law, which is one of the equations, one of the constraints of your theory, which is shared with Jahn-Mills theory, in fact. So the exterior derivative of the electric field must vanish. So this term is gone. So you have an expression of your two-dimensional smeared fluxes in terms of three-dimensional integrals. And now you're ready to use the commutation relations to compute the commutators of two electric fluxes. And in one line, you find that these electric fluxes are non-commutative, and the algebra is extremely simple. The commutator of two electric fields is given by the electric field smeared with the algebra commutator of smearings. So, but these electric fields carry geometric information, and in fact, you can write things like the area of a surface in terms of them. The area of a surface is written by this expression in terms of square root of the square of these electric fields, and you can also write the volume of regions, of three-dimensional regions, by a similar expression. Now, basically, these operators will acquire a discrete spectrum, and the reason behind, or the quick way of getting an intuition of why, is that these electric fields satisfy angular momentum commutation relations. And so in the quantum theory, when promoted to operators, you would expect angular momentum type of discreteness in their spectrum. Of course, this is very formal. What one has to do is actually construct the Hilbert space of the theory in which these quantities act as self-adjoint operators. This has been done in series of results that go from 91 to 2006. So the Hilbert space of Luc quantum gravity admits a basis with a very nice and clear geometric interpretation. This is the spin network basis, which is given by states which are supported on polymer-like excitations, graphs, one-dimensional graphs, whose links can be thought of as fluxes of quantized area, and the nodes where these links intersect can in principle be labeled by eigenvalues of the volume operator. So now this is the kinematics. What about dynamics? So the dynamics in general relativity, in the theory in quantum gravity, in the canonical formulation of quantum gravity, is completely controlled by constraints. So the dynamics at the quantum level corresponds to quantizing the different constraints of the theory and finding solutions, namely states in your that are annihilated by the constraints. These are the generators of gate transformations that we have encountered already in the previous slides, G, the generators of three diffeomorphisms along shift vector fields, and there is an A missing here inside, and the scalar constraint, which generates time reparametrization and is mirrored with a lapse function M. So this satisfies a certain algebra of commutations, which is very natural and geometric for this couple of constraints here, coming from the symmetries that they generate. But there is a piece of the algebra which is especially complicated, and this is the only one that I'm emphasizing here. So the commutator between a scalar constraint with another scalar constraint with two different smearings is given by, is equal to the vector constraint smeared with the shift vector, which is field dependent. It is defined in terms of one of the dynamical variables, which is the three metric, which in principle, of course, I could write in terms of the electric fields. And so one would expect that a quantization of these constraints, which encoded the quantum dynamics, should satisfy this algebra. So in 96, Thiemann, in a seminal paper, succeeded in quantizing the scalar constraint, which is also called the Hamiltonian constraint. However, the way he did it, which was taken with great optimism because it was a breakthrough, was by considering the action of a regularized scalar constraint, and the removing the regulator was done by considering the action of this constraint on diffeomorphism invariant states, which are well-defined objects in the theory. Now, because he was doing that, then the anomaly freeness condition reduced to simply that the commutator of scalar constraint would have to vanish in the space of diffeomorphism invariant states that are annihilated by the right-hand side of these commutation relations. And so it was observed that this was too weak, and it led to too many ambiguities in the construction of the Hamiltonian constraint. And also the left the idea clear that one was not actually checking the absence of anomaly in a reliable way, which will require to actually check it off shell before imposing the vector constraint. This was one of the first objections that the quantization had. Another problem that the Thiemann's Hamiltonian had and was emphasized by Lee Smalling in 96 is what I try to represent by this cartoon here, is that the action of the Hamiltonian was ultra-local, and it seemed by that solutions of the Hamiltonian constraint or the scalar constraint would correspond to just dressing of vertices in spin networks, where nothing would just propagate from one vertex, from one node to another. And so it would seem that solutions of this type of Hamiltonian constraints will never allow for the propagation of degrees of freedom as one would expect for gravitons. Okay, both of these problems are in the way of being solved thanks to a list of results and the work basically led by Madhavan Bharadarajan from 2011 until today. And I don't have any time to actually say, the work is extremely technical, but the idea is that Madhavan has found a way by using, by being careful in the way these regularized constraints are constructed, he has a way of checking non-trivially the validity of the commutation relations. He has done this at the moment only in the Smalling weak coupling model, which consists of replacing SU2 by U1 to the third. This makes some things easier, some manipulations simpler. And he has shown that some version of this Hamiltonian constraints actually produce non-trivial propagation. Now, he's working on trying to generalize this to the real case with the gauge group equal to SU2, and everything seems to suggest that the generalization is possible, okay? And just for the, keep in mind that the action of the constraint, I mean, this is only a cartoon picture, basically maps nodes of the spin network into modifications of the node in which new links are being created. And this is something that is reminiscent of the what one finds in another approach to dynamics in loop quantum gravity, which developed in parallel precisely because of the difficulty in dealing with the quantization of the Hamiltonian constraint. So spin foams is meant to be a path integral representation of the physical inner product. So the physical inner product can be seen as the matrix, can be thought of as a matrix element of an operator, of a projection operator into the kernel of all the constraints of the theory. So if you find these transition amplitudes, then you have under control the physical Hilbert space. Now, it turns out that these amplitudes, which depend on two spin networks, can be written as a sum over numbers of sum over amplitudes corresponding to histories of spin networks, in which you have an initial spin network evolving into the final spin network, which initial and final are the boundary spin networks in your physical inner product. Now, typically, you can access, in some situations, you can access the spin form representation both canonically and covariantly. And this simplest case in which you can do that is topological theories such as BF theory, and in particular in gravity in three dimensions. So there you can start from the Hamiltonian formulation, you construct the constraints, the quantum constraints, there are no problem with anomalies in that case. And when you construct the projection into the kernel of the constraints, you find that they admit an expression as a sum over histories of this form, a spin form representation. Conversely, you can start from the action and introduce a cellular decomposition, so a discretization that allows you to regularize the formal path integral, and then compute transition amplitudes, and you check that you get exactly the same result. Now, in four dimensions, things are more complicated because the Hamiltonian version of the Hamiltonian path, if you want, has been unavailable until now. And perhaps the recent work of Madhavan will change this in the future. So because that was unavailable, the only path was to actually regularize the formal path integral. And the way this is done is by considering the path integral associated to BF theory and then imposing a constraint on the sum over histories that would restrict the B field to be of the simple form, of this form, implying that if you consistently apply these constraints, then you would be writing a candidate of path integral for four-dimensional gravity. And this can be done, and this leads to also a spin form amplitude, very similar to those that you find in three dimensions. So spin form amplitudes are basically controlled by something that is called the vertex amplitude. In three dimensional, this is the 6J symbol that gives you the amplitude for a transition, an elementary transition that this one. In four dimensions, you get something more complicated, which is called the 15J or the vertex amplitude in four dimensions. But the key point is that unlike three dimensions, because four-dimensional gravity has local degrees of freedom, then delta, the cellular decomposition that you introduce as a truncation on the sum of possible speed network histories remains, so amplitudes depend on this regulator. So you need a non-trivial way of removing this regulator. So as I said, these amplitudes have been defined. The vertex amplitude satisfies interesting, very appealing semi-classical properties. In fact, when you look at for simplex amplitude in the large spin limit, you can see that it is related to the exponential of the Regge action for a single vertex. And when you consider a full cellular decomposition, then things are more complicated and under investigation. There are some results and some discussion, and this is the main point of the discussion is whether you obtain something that is compatible with general relativity in the semi-classical limit. But the key question is how to get rid of the regulator dependence delta, which is often referred to as the continuum limit. And so the main idea is that renormalization tools are necessary to answer this question. The continuum limit is to be found as a fixed point in which the regulator dependence disappears. If you refine this regulator, this cellular decomposition, then your amplitudes stop changing. So renormalization is studied in models to build up experience of a renormalization group flow in a context which is completely background independent, because I mean, I should emphasize that this regulator, this cellular decomposition, does not carry any metric information. It's just it's only topological information that is encoded in it. It only restricts the type of histories that you're summing over. So one has to devise the whole theory of renormalization in a context where there are no scales for describing the running in the standard way. And then other important results is that analytic simplifications in the expression of these spin form amps have led to efficient numerical evaluation codes and first attempts to actually explore how these amplitudes change when one does coarse graining. So there are also other new interesting developments on that I want to very quickly mention. There is work on 3D which relate ADF CFT approaches to the loopy representation. There are very interesting results by Wolfgang Wielen expressing observables that have discrete spectrum in terms of integrals of spinorial fields living on boundaries. And there is the whole development, the edge modes by people essentially at PI. So the idea is that if one concentrates on observables defined on boundaries of three-dimensional balls or pieces of space, then in addition to the effluxes, SU2 charges that I described in some detail before, one has a much richer structure. In particular, one has an induced metric that leads to SL2R charges on the boundary, and there are boost charges also that appear when you relax the time gauge condition that you can do in when you look at observables this way. And of course, also the three diffeomorphism charges. So this is an interesting approach to probably finding a different and richer parameterization of the degrees of freedom encoded in loop quantum gravity. So now let me go to some important aspects of what we can do with what we have so far. So, and this is a personal account, and I'm gonna be very quick. So one of the key things is that in loop quantum gravity, smooth geometry and smooth fields living on it is to be thought as an emergent quantity, emergent notions. So at the fundamental level, space-time is fundamentally discrete and combinatorial. And if you, there is nothing that corresponds, say, to flat space in loop quantum gravity or flat space-time in loop quantum gravity. There is no state associated to flat space-time, but rather we expect that the notion of flat space-time or any smooth geometry as something arising via coarse grading. And because coarse grading is involved, then we expect that once we fix the notion of smooth geometry, then corresponding to that notion defined by coarse grain low energy observers, there will be a great degeneracy of fundamental degrees of freedom. And this degeneracy is in fact what is responsible, we believe, for the black hole entropy in our approach. And for that, so there is a simple way of understanding the black hole entropy calculation in understanding the idea behind the black hole entropy calculation in loop quantum gravity. And this is to keep in mind the idea, basically by Sorkin, that black hole entropy should be related to entanglement entropy. And so I'm going to just glance this, show you this transparency very quickly. But the point is that in quantum field theory, if you define entanglement entropy by tracing out internal degrees of freedom of the black hole for a given quantum state, what you find is divergent and ambiguous terms, which in four dimensions happen to be proportional to the area, but they are ill-defined in quantum field theory. So the idea is that in a theory where there are no ultraviolet divergences, such as loop quantum gravity, where we don't expect, because of the regulating nature of the Planckian discreteness, this would be divergent term should become finite. And it's easy to argue that this has to be given by the dimensionality of the space, of the Hilbert space of boundary states corresponding to a given black hole with a given area. So again, the idea is that when I fix a smooth geometry corresponding to some black hole of a given area, because I am a coarse grain observer, then corresponding to this state, macroscopic state, there are many microscopic states which contribute to the entropy of the black hole. And so this can be calculated via the isolated horizon model of the boundary degrees of freedom. And the result is that you have something that is finite. This Hilbert space is finite dimensional. The entropy is proportional to the area. And the result depends on the Emirsi parameter, that coupling that we encountered before in my slides. And there is this numerical number that has to do with the counting. So for quite some time, the view has been that if you fixed this coupling in the topological term of the action you started with, then this will be compatible with the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. And this is not very convincing to everybody. And there is still perhaps a discussion about that, but there is the feeling that if there are arguments actually suggesting that the inclusion of matter into the picture would actually lead to the Bekenstein-Hawking result without having to fix the Emirsi parameter to a particular value. Okay, so again, the key property here is that there is a multiplicity of microstates associated to a given low, geometry, classical geometry, as defined by coarse grain observers. And this is the origin of black hole entropy. Another thing that it's very nice about loop quantum gravity is that one can define symmetry reduced models that describe cosmology. And the existence of discreteness at the fundamental level leads to something, the generic resolution of the Big Bang singularity. And so generically, in loop quantum cosmology, the universe doesn't go through a Big Bang, but rather there is a big bounce. The universe can be in a state in which it is shrinking towards a big crunch, and it goes through the would-be singularity and bounces back to a universe that is expanding on the other side. And if one puts the standard test fields on top of the background satisfying these dynamics, and one analyzes, for example, the effects of inflation and the inflaton field in structure formation in the power spectrum of the CMB, one finds results which are compatible with observations. And in the low infrared sector, possible phenomenology that could be of great interest. Another type of mini superspace models is the quantization of spherically symmetric black holes inside the interior of black holes. And there too, the interior singularities are completely resolved by quantum effects. And so there is a variety of models, but the picture I want to, what I want to emphasize is that from this, a scenario for black hole evaporation comes out naturally, which is represented by this Penrose diagram that I show you here on the right. So of course, we are not able yet to include back reaction and compute how a black hole evaporates in the quantum theory, but we know that there shouldn't be any singularity. Singularity is to be avoided according to the models that we actually have. And so the Penrose diagram looks a little bit like this. So we have an initial black hole that forms Hawking radiation that shrinks the black hole into the future. Into the future in this region, we expect the space-time to become flat again. And there is a green region here that we don't understand in full detail, but just for that, we will need the full theory, where quantum gravity effects are important. And but this Penrose diagram suggests an interesting resolution of the information paradox in black hole evaporation. It says, in fact, at present, there are two possible scenarios, I would say, in our framework. So if you assume that quantum field theoretical degrees of excitations can evolve across this quantum gravity region, and that they capture the correlations with the Hawking radiation that has been evaporated before, then you would expect these red modes here to purify the Hawking radiation. But because they have to be very, very low energy, because if you trust semi-classical calculations, the black hole has shrunk up to essentially the Planck mass by this retarded time here, then a back of the envelope calculation shows that in order to achieve purification, you need this green region to last for a very, very long time as measured by retarded time here in the future, in future not infinity. So you get essentially something that is equivalent to a remnant scenario, a very long lasting quasi stable remnant. But the other possibility is that when Hawking pairs fall into the would-be singularity, they interact with the Planckian structure of the space-time, and they transfer their correlations to defects in the underlying Planckian fabric of the space-time. Defects that are of the same type that we counted in the definition, in the counting that led to our black hole entropy calculation. In that case, then, again, there are uncertainties about how long this green region would be, because we would need to know the dynamics, but only taking into account purification time, then you see that this green region can be as short as the mass of the initial black hole to the 2/3, which for a solar mass black hole corresponds to approximately 1/10 of the Bohr radius translated into time. So very short-lived remnants. And so this is a generally new scenario for the resolution of the black hole information paradox. And it's a scenario that we can test precisely in quantum cosmology, because in quantum cosmology too, for every eigenstate of the energy of the universe, which one has, for every eigenvalue, sorry, there is a huge degeneracy associated to Planckian defects that are not that are hidden to low energy observers. So that's the mathematical property of loop quantum cosmology. And so one can construct an initial state that will go through a big crunch, okay, which is a linear combination of two of these states that are macroscopically equivalent but differ in some quantum defect at the Planck scale. And you show that if you do things so that the reduced density matrix that you obtain by tracing out the unobservable degrees of freedoms for a low energy observer, so that the initial density matrix is pure, dynamics generically would generate correlations with these underlying defects, so that your reduced density matrix will become mixed on the other side. So in spite of the fact that the unitary evolution, there is a unitary evolution at the fundamental level, for low energy observers, they would think that there is an evolution from pure density matrix into mixed density matrix. So information is not destroyed here, it's only degraded, like in the case I burn a book or a newspaper.
Alexander, sorry, you have about 3 minutes.
Okay, thank you. So I don't have a very a long time, but I just want to really quickly mention this, and maybe I can come back if there are questions. This is a completely phenomenological model. and is related to loop quantum gravity only conceptually. So with the assumption of this discreteness and with these results of on information, if we can correlate with this underlying granularity, then it's naturally to expect that you could have diffusion. And if you have diffusion in the context of cosmology, you can show by using a slight modification of general relativity that this diffusion would lead to, which is the trace-free Einstein's equations, would lead to the feeding of the dark energy term. So we constructed a model based on only the assumption of discreteness and that discreteness should be accessible via field probes that actually, so via a way that has to be diffeomorphism invariant. We came up with an essentially unique model for the leading contribution that is parametrized by a single dimensionless parameter, alpha, which produces a contribution to the cosmological constant, which is exactly of the right order of magnitude to explain observations. So let me just finish. So the main, with a few points, the main insights produced are the fact that we can actually produce models that give us a very clear picture of a natural description of the origin of black hole entropy. It's not the ultimate picture yet. Matter needs to play a role, in my opinion. Singularity resolution is absolutely clear in these models of quantum cosmology, as well as in spherically symmetric collapse models. And this leads to potentially rich phenomenology in quantum cosmology and black holes. And it provides this fundamental discreteness and novel mechanism for the resolution of the information puzzle in black hole evaporation, and a phenomenological model for thinking of the origin of the cosmological constant. Open problems. We need more control on the dynamics, but there are good news. So on the spin foam front, it's clear that regulatory independence has to be achieved via renormalization. And there is ongoing work in trying to understand this. And one of the things I like about this is that suddenly we have a flow of theories that will appear from this renormalization. And in a way, we are flowing away from that very special starting point that led to the whole construction, which was a particular action for general relativity to which we apply canonical methods. So there are issues about reconstructing the semi-classical limit and people working on this. One important open question is how does the low energy Lorentz invariants reconcile with the fundamental discreteness? And of course, matter couplings, can we do anything with matter, or are there non-trivial consistency requirements in the formalism that could restrict and guide us for a more fundamental understanding of matter? This is not so well explored, and I'm giving you some examples here. And my model for the cosmological constant, I think, is also qualifying as in this direction. Finally, so the status of loop quantum gravity. Loop quantum gravity is an ongoing effort to produce a background independent quantization of gravity in four dimensions with basic variables that are extended and non-local. It provides a concrete formalism where all the notions of the theory are clearly defined and carry a concrete geometric interpretation. And this produces a framework where the natural question what we'd like to ask to quantum gravity can be formulated. One of the key features is the fundamental discreteness and the necessity of recovering smoothness as an emergent product. Recent developments at the canonical level, anomaly free quantization of the scalar constraint, as well as the numerical and analytic progress in computing spin foam amplitudes, picture a promise of relevant progress, in my view. Thank you very much.
Okay, you can all give applause in the participants list by clicking on the applause button. Okay.
Thank you.
There were a couple of raised hands. I think Lee Smolin was first. The second one that I saw earlier was Steve Giddings. I don't know if that's still a question, but that might be the second one. So let's start with Lee.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, Lee.
Can you hear me? Yes. Alejandro, that's a beautiful summary of both new work and old work. you didn't mention issues connected and with anomalies, with chirality, and so forth, but certainly we must have something to say about those. Because yes, that is a part of nature.
I completely agree. I think this is a very important loose end of our approach, but I think there is a raising consciousness that this has to be done. And it's necessary for the black hole entropy calculation. It is necessary for cosmology. It is necessary for everything. So yeah. I agree. But I did mention some results here which are related to that. For instance, this fermion coupling consistency. I meant the fermion doubling problem and some yeah. indications that in low quantum gravity maybe there are mechanisms that will resolve what naively would seem like a problem in a discrete approach. And,
I'm the author of the paper that says that naively there is a problem. So this
yes,
is,
yes, this I know. Yeah. Yes, I know. I didn't cite the authors of the problem. But
just quickly, while we're talking about discrete symmetries, when you have this diffusion into this complicated, very large number of microscopic states, is there any hope of the effective theory being time reversal invariant?
No, it shouldn't be time reversal invariant, but the effect might be very tiny. But I mean, if this is correct, then I wouldn't think that physics is time. I mean, the low energy physics, of course, the coarse grain low energy physics in general wouldn't be time reversal invariant, but for reasons that are similar to those that that imply that there is an arrow of time in our universe, namely that for some reason that remains to be explained, the universe is very low entropy in the past. Okay, it's very well organized in the past, and so because there are all these underlying multiplicity of microscopic degrees of freedom, then from the macroscopic perspective, then time reversal invariance is lost. But I mean, I think you're asking whether at the fundamental level we will break time reversal invariance.
I'm asking whether the theory can serve. It might, your scenario might work, but it's dangerous. It's dangerous to imagine breaking time reversal invariance.
No, I'm not breaking time reversal invariant at the fundamental level. I am saying time reversal invariant will be an illusion of describing physics with coarse grain quantities. It's like if I burn the newspaper, it looks like I cannot recover my newspaper anymore, and I have an irreversible process that for someone that wants to read newspapers looks like an breaking situation. But we know that at the microscopic level nothing breaks time reversal invariant in burning a newspaper. I think that's the type of phenomenon okay. that I have in mind.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we've got Daniel Harlow next.
Hi. So I was just curious if you could say a little more about why, I think you probably explained this in the beginning and I just didn't quite get it. How did you get to SU2? I would have naively guessed you would be talking about SO3,1.
Okay, it's quite easy. It's here, okay. So you have an internal Lorentz symmetry in this action. So these internal indices go from 0 to 3 or from 1 to 4, if you want. Uh-huh. So this and this connection is a Lorentz connection, and we're going to do now the canonical formulation in which you foliate your space time in terms of space leaves, okay. And you want to write the Hamiltonian, the initial value problem, if you want, in Hamiltonian form. You're going to give initial data on a three-dimensional surface, which is space-like and evolved. So we're using the structure of this Cauchy surface, of this space-like surface, to partially gauge fix. What do? We take the time-like member of the tetrad and we fix it to be in the direction of the normal, which is a time-like vector, the normal to a space-like surface. And so now the only gauge symmetry that remains is the one that fixes this time-like direction, and this is an SO3.
But somehow, don't you, like, at some point you're going to do a step where you break the boost symmetry, right? Like here, it just looks like a gauge fixing. But somehow, well, in what did you did later, the SU2 is preserved exactly, but maybe this SO3,1 is not.
So what you fix a time-like vector, and so yeah. the subgroup that you get is SO3 or SU2.
The manifest yeah. subgroup, right? But if it's really just a gauge fixing, then there should it's still not be a boost symmetry.
So once you give the structure of your foliation, then then you have the foliation deformation, the constraints
well,
actually.
Well, maybe what I'm asking is whether things really depend on the choice of foliation or not.
In fact, the whole Hamiltonian formulation needs this foliation, but then the existence of the constraints and their algebra, which actually sometimes is called the foliation deformation or surface deformation algebra, is there. I mean, these constraints that you have to satisfy in the physical Hilbert space or in the classical theory you have to satisfy for initial data are there so that physics is independent of the foliation. Okay. So until you don't impose the constraints, then you don't have foliation independence.
Well, I guess I understand that classically. I guess in the quantum theory, it seemed like it might depend on this cellular decomposition that you were doing, or that kind of thing might break the symmetry.
Yes, that's true. I mean, in forms, this regulating structure breaks partially the diffeomorphism invariance. And mm-hmm. this is why one needs methods for removing this regulator. In some cases, this is trivial when the theory is topological. In four-dimensional gravity, this is non-trivial, and the renormalization.
So you agree that in the regulated theory, it is foliation dependent because of this?
It is to some extent, you know, breaking diffeomorphism invariance and therefore foliation independence.
Thank you.
Okay, we're running quite late. I just want to take one more question from Steve Giddings, which was a raised hand from the very beginning, I think.
Yes, thank you. And thanks for a very nice talk. Resolutions of the information problem are constrained by things like basic principles of quantum mechanics, locality or approximate locality, energy conservation. And so, for example, the remnant scenario leads to a disaster because of unbounded production of remnants. Mm-hmm. I'm asking about this new proposal, when you talk about Planckian defects, I'm wondering if you've thought about giving an effective theory of Planckian defects. For example, are they localized objects? Do they have an energy as measured at infinity, and so on? And if they do, you might think you were going to run into some of those traditional issues.
I agree. No, these Planckian defects do not carry energy in some sense. I mean, they have to do with the point I am, you know, the hypothesis here is that when we talk about flat space-time and vacuum living on it, this notion is a coarse-grained notion valid for effective field theories, but they miss this Planckian, but this, so one of these this state, the vacuum state on flat space-time, is highly degenerate due to these tiny defects at the Planckian scale. So, but all macroscopic observers will agree that the ADM mass, for example, or that the bonding mass of that state is zero. So this gives you the possibility of encoding information without diffusion, encoding information without affecting the energy budget. And this is exactly what happens in this cosmological model. So for a given energy of your universe, because there is a way of talking about the energy of the universe, it happens to be the cosmological constant. They are, for every eigen state of the cosmological constant, there are infinitely many eigenvalues that differ in data that is not accessible at low energies. So they do not affect energy balance in the sense that they do not change the cosmological constant. This is a degeneracy for every eigenstate of the cosmological constant. Similarly, in the full theory, we expect from what we know, although one will need to prove this, and for that one we need to have under control the continuum limit, but we expect that when we say Minkowski space-time and the vacuum on top, that would correspond to a large ensemble of microscopic states in the fundamental theory that you cannot describe in an effective field theory. Effective field theories that use smooth fields miss those degrees of freedom.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I think we have to leave it there given that we're running quite late. So let's thank Alejandro again for his very nice talk.
Thank you. Thank you very much.